the CS50 Quiz Zero review session. I'm Camille, and I'm going to be going over some topics with you guys today to help you prepare for the quiz. So here is our non-exhaustive list of topics you should be familiar with for the quiz. These were taken directly from the syllabus. I know it seems like a lot, but trust me, you've learned all of these things in the past few weeks. So we'll definitely be going over a lot of these today, but also take some time on your own to review these things. And if you aren't familiar with what some of these things are, make sure you ask one of us. Also, for the official word on the quiz, go to this link. This will have all the information with which room you need to go in, split up alphabetically, and also some tips on what materials you should be studying and what sort of quiz questions you can expect. So make sure to check that out. Also, some tips for when you are preparing for the exam. Practice coding on paper. I know you've gotten used to having the IDE check some of your errors for you, and it's when you're typing things up, it's a little different than having to write things out. So practice doing some coding. Some good functions to practice doing are Sterlen and A2i, seeing if you can write those out on your own. Be familiar with the problem sets. Most years, there are questions that relate to some of the problem set material, so make sure that you understand how to do all the problem sets. Try doing some of the old quizzes under the 75-minute time constraint. A lot of the quizzes can be kind of long, so it's a good way to give yourself some practice in how long it will take you and how you should divide your time to make sure you finish everything by the end. And also, you get a one-page, two-sided reference sheet that you can write whatever you want on to use during the quiz. So when you're creating that, that's also a really great way to study because you'll kind of be reviewing things as you're writing it. So any general questions about the quiz or how it works? Yeah?
Will that list of topics that you just showed be available to us anyway?
This entire slideshow will be posted to the website. Also, the video of today's review session will be on the website. So don't worry too much about writing things down throughout. Yeah, it'll all be there. Any other questions? Okay, so let's get started. So one thing to be familiar with is the different data types and the size that they take on. This may also be a great thing to write down in your reference sheet just to make sure you remember all of these. But so chars are 1 byte, ints are 4 bytes, a long, which is basically like more space for an integer, is 8 bytes, a float is 4 bytes, a double, which basically gives you more space to store a float, is 8 bytes, and then a pointer is also 8 bytes. Any questions about these? So binary is another topic we've covered a little bit this semester. So let's do some practice with converting between binary and decimal. Does anyone have any idea what that first one would be? Oh, anyone? Yeah, it's 42. So if you remember, each of the places in binary is basically like 2 to that place's power. So that first spot is 2 to the 0th power, and we have 0 there, so nothing there. The next place is 2 to the first power, and we do have a 1 there, so that's basically a 2. The next place is 2 to the second, which is 4. We don't have anything there. The next place over is 2 to the third, which would be 8, and we do have one there, and if we keep going, that last, the furthest to the left one is where we have 32. And so we basically have 32 plus 8 plus 2 to get 42. Any questions?
What's the subscript for?
The subscript basically tells us it's binary.
Oh.
So there's a 2 there. If they were, like, in the next one, when we're converting decimal to binary, there's a 10 showing us that this number is originally in decimal.
Thank you.
Yeah. Any other questions on that one? Okay, so let's try the next one then, decimal to binary. So taking 50 and putting that in binary. How would you do that? Yeah. Yes. So one, an easy way to think about converting from decimal to binary is to, it often helps to write out what the different powers of 2 are and then go through it and seeing whatever the highest one of those is that you can put into the decimal number without going over it. So in this case, like one of the powers of 2 is 32. So 32 goes into 50, but the next power up would be 64, which obviously doesn't fit into 50. So the highest one we have is the 32. The next one down is 16, and 32 plus 16 is only 48, so that still fits into 50. So we have ones in both of those, and then if we keep going down, the only thing we need left is two more to get from 48 to 50. So then we have a 1 in that position, and a 0 in the last position, because there's nothing in the 2 to the 0th place. Questions on converting decimal to binary? Okay, so now let's try doing some binary addition. How would you add those two up? Yeah. Yes. So doing addition in binary is pretty much the same as doing it in decimal, except if you have two ones being added together, 1 plus 1 is 2, but 2 in binary is 1, 0. So you have to carry the 1 and keep carrying it for those couple columns, and other than that, just add normally. Any questions on that? Yeah.
Sorry, what is the last place? There's 6 numbers. So like the leftmost column, what value is that?
And this bottom one?
On the top one for 50.
For 50? Oh, so the leftmost one is 32.
32.
Yeah. So it'd be 32, 16, then 8, 4, 2. 0, or 1. Well, it's 2 to the 0th, which is 1. Yeah. Any other questions on this? Okay. So then we're going to do a little bit with hexadecimal. So this might be a little bit less familiar, because I know we've done a lot more with binary, but a really good way to think about hexadecimal is to break up a binary number into 4-bit chunks, because each 4 bits of a binary number is basically 1 of the hexadecimal numbers. So if we have this first one, we have basically 8 ones. So those can be split up. Say that again?
255 in decimal or OXFF in hexadecimal.
Yeah, it is. So if you split that up into 2 4-bit chunks, we basically have 4 sets of 1, which is the maximum we can get with 4 bits in binary, and the maximum we could get for that in hexadecimal would be an F. So we would have 2 Fs. Any questions on that? Yeah. Sure. So each basically place of hexadecimal is equivalent to 4 bits of a binary. So the easiest way to do this is to break it up into 4-bit chunks. So in this case, we have 8 ones. So if we split those into 2 4-bit chunks, we would have 2 sets of 4 ones. And each one of those is equivalent to F. If you think about, I know our brains are kind of wired to think more through decimal, because that's what we're used to. So one way you could think of it is the 4 ones is equal to 15. In decimal, and 15 in hexadecimal is F. So that's another way that you can think through it. Yeah?
What's the OX for?
The OX denotes that it's hexadecimal.
Oh.
Yeah, so we just put that prefix there normally. Yeah. Other questions on that? Okay, so let's try going the other way then. In this case, we have, sorry? We're going to binary, so. Going the other way. But in this case, we have 5 and A. So if we think about this, if each of those, the 5 and the A, are both going to represent a 4-bit chunk, how do you say 5 in binary? Yeah, so that's the 0, 1, 01 part. And then how would you say A in? Say it, sorry? Yeah, so that's the second part of it. And then if you put those two together, that's how you get the full binary for the hexadecimal. Yeah? So if you, so when you're going through binary, basically binary has 0 through 9 and then A through F as its 16 things. So if all the way 0 to 9, if you, 9 and then A is basically, if we converted it to decimal, A would be like 10, B would be like 11. And so if you think about the binary 1010, is 8 and 2, because those are the two places, so that adds up to 10, which is exactly what A is equivalent to. So that's kind of an easy way to think about that. Other questions on hexadecimal? Okay. So now we're going to take a look at bitwise operators. So these can definitely come up on the quiz. I know we haven't worked with them a lot, but we're just going to do a little review of these. So hopefully these will be a little bit more familiar to you. So the 6 bitwise operators that we have are listed here, and they let us manipulate individual bits. So the AND operator is a single ampersand. Don't confuse that with the double ampersand, which is the logical AND. That lets us compare two things. The single AND is how we can manipulate things bitwise. So this gives us the result of one if both of the arguments that we're comparing are the same, or are one. And the vertical bar OR will give us one if at least one of them is one. So basically exactly what the words imply. And if the two bits are one, one and one gives us one. But with the OR, if it's zero or one, or one or one, in either case, we have one as being one of them, so then we would get a one.
What do you mean it says it gives one?
The result. Kind of like it would, if you did zero and one, the result of that would be one. Or zero and one, but the result of that would be zero. Sorry. Yeah, it was kind of the result of the expression. Yeah. And then this caret symbol is the XOR or exclusive OR, so that means exclusively one or exactly one of the two arguments is equal to one, and then it would give you one. The little squiggly line is the NOT operator, so unlike the rest of them, which operate on a pair of bits, the NOT operator only takes one bit and will flip it. So if you do NOT zero, it would give you one, and if you do NOT one, it would give you zero. Yeah. So the OR with two lines is the logical OR. So that's for comparing like two full integers or two to see if things are equal, or like doing this is equal to this or this is equal to this type thing. Whereas the single bar OR is for doing things bitwise. Yeah.
What do you mean by bitwise?
So bitwise is working directly with the bits in binary.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, so working with zeros and ones. Yeah, we'll do a couple examples of this after, just so it's not too confusing. And then the last two are the left shift and the right shift, which are basically two less than signs or two greater than signs. And they shift a bit the given number of places that you give it in the direction. So it would either shift it to the left or to the right. Yeah. We're going to go through an example in a second, so hopefully that will help. Any questions on just what's up here before? Okay. So going through some examples, let's start with the AND ones. What would we get if we did 0 and 1?
0.
Okay, and if we did 1 and 1? Yeah. What if we did 0 or 1? How about 1 or 1? Okay. How about 0 XOR 1? And 1 XOR 1?
0.
Okay, they're good. How about not 0 and not 1?
0.
Okay. And then this last one's a little one with the shifting. So if we initially set x to be 8, and then y is x shifted to the left 3, what would that give us? Say that again? So this actually gives us 64. So I'm just going to write this up here so this makes a little bit of sense. If we have 2 to the 0, 2 to the 1, 2 to the 2. 2 to the 3 is going to be 8. And if we want to shift it 3 more bits to the left, that would be 2 to the 4, 2 to the 5, and 2 to the 6th. And 2 to the 6th is 64. Does that make sense? Yes.
Does that shift all the ones and zeros of the binary number?
Yes. And you won't have to worry on the quiz about these being negative. We won't make you deal with negative shifts in any way. Okay. Any other questions about this? Yes. Yeah, you would just add zeros on in the original. One hundred shifted to the right, so that would take all of the ones and zeros and just shift them to the right as many times as you tell it to shift to the right. Well, 100. Are you talking about 100 in binary or 100 in decimal? 100 in binary. If you shift it to the right, like if you shift it to the right once, it would become 10. If you shift it to the right twice, it would become 001. And if you shift it again, you kind of lose a bit. Yeah, that's a zero. Any other questions on this? Yes.
So does it become 0, 0, 0?
Yes. Yeah. Okay. So then let's go through a little bit of ASCII math. So characters can essentially be treated as integers based on their ASCII values. So if we set int a equals 65, int b equals a plus 1, int char c equals d minus 1, and char d equals 68, what would print out at the bottom? So we're printing these, bless you, we're printing these all out as chars based on the percent c. So we're basically printing out the character value of all four of these variables. The hint, 65 is the ASCII value of capital A. Maybe that helps? What?
ABCD.
Yeah. So this would print out exactly ABCD because we set int A equal to the ASCII value of A. So if we print that out as a character, we just get capital A. A plus 1 would be a capital B in ASCII. D minus 1 would be a capital C in ASCII. And 68 is the ASCII value of D. Questions on ASCII? Yes. It uses, it counts, so single quotes around the A makes it a character, and if you're dealing with it in a number form, so when, like in this case, it's being dealt with as an int, then it would deal with its ASCII value. Yeah. Yes? I don't think. I think we would do it with easy things. I don't think it would hurt to write down maybe like what capital A and lowercase a are, just so you know what those ranges are starting with, but I don't think you need to take up all the space to put a whole ASCII table. Yeah?
What's the difference between, like, say, int A and char C, like using int versus the char?
So it's just how that's stored in memory, but you can treat it either way. Like we see here, we do print out the A as a character. Yeah. Yeah. Any other questions? Yes.
So even if like A has only been defined as an integer, if we try to print a char as a 65, okay, cool.
It would go to the, basically goes to the ASCII chart and gets whatever character is in the ASCII chart for that 65.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, if you did all four percent I's, it would print out the ASCII values of all four of these. Any other questions? Okay. So scope. Basically, this helps us determine where a variable exists in your program. So we've talked about two different types of scope, global and local. If a variable is globally scoped, it means your entire program has access to that variable. And if you globally scope a variable, you declare it before your main function. So it's done right off the bat, and then your whole program can access it. If it's only locally scoped, that variable is confined to a specific region. So if you declare it within a for loop, only that for loop can access it. Or if you declare it within a specific function, only that function can access it. Questions on scope? Okay. So function prototyping. Basically, because C, when it compiles, reads top down, if you declare a function later in your code, the compiler doesn't know that that function exists. So what we use are prototypes, which basically tell the compiler, this function exists, go look for it later in the code. So the way that you do a function prototype is exactly how you start off writing a function. You give the return type, the name of the function, and then any arguments that that function takes. So to look at a quick example, in this case, our function that we're using here is basically a cube function, so taking in an integer and returning the cube of that integer. So because we've written that function below the main function and we want to use that, the output of that, or we want to use that function in our main function, we put its prototype way at the top of our program, and then when we call it in our main function, the compiler knows that that function is written later and we'll go look for it and we'll use it properly. Questions on prototyping? Yes.
Okay, go. What's the point of prototyping? Why not just have it down there?
Well, if it's down here, then when you get to the line cube of x in your main function, the compiler will have no idea that the cube function actually exists. It's better coding practice to put it under your main function, so that's why we do the prototyping. Just because if you had a lot of functions, it would be really messy to read through all those functions before you get to the meat of your program. Yeah, and you had a... Yeah, if you're creating other functions, main itself is a function. So if you're creating other functions, they should be outside. Yes?
What's percent d?
Percent d is the same thing as percent I. Refers to an integer. Yes? Void says it takes in no arguments. Can you speak a little louder? Sorry?
Yeah.
Oh, for the two different, for the main function versus the cube function? Okay, so in the main function, we use void because there are no parameters being taken in, whereas in the cube function, we have an input. That's why it says int input, because there are arguments that we're taking in to run our function. Yeah. Other questions? Okay. And so then quickly, floating point and precision. So we have infinitely many real numbers, but there are only a finite number of bits that we can use to display those numbers and represent them. So then we end up with some imprecision. And your numbers won't always be quite exactly what you think they are when you're dealing with floating points. This is just something good to know. Questions on this? They're completely separate, yeah. Yeah. Okay. Great.
We can talk more about that.
Hi, everyone. My name is Bullock, and I'll be going over pointers. Okay, so let's first think about what memory looks like. So as you can see here, we take memory, and we divide it up into a bunch of blocks, and we reference each block by an address, right? And does anyone remember what type of notation we use to denote an address? Hexadecimal, right? So the 0x means we're talking about hexadecimal. Okay, so how do we create pointers? So we take the type, we put add a star to it, and then we add the variable name, right? So the examples we've seen are int star x, char star y, and float star z. So when I say int star x, can someone tell me what I'm kind of talking about there? Sorry, what? Can you repeat that?
The location
of an int. So actually, so what I meant is when we have int star x, what we're saying is we're creating a pointer, and it can store the address of a variable that's an int, right? So with char star y, we're creating a pointer, right, that can store the address of a variable that's a char. Does that make sense to everyone? Okay, cool. Okay, so with pointers, there are two important operations we can do. There's referencing and there's dereferencing. Yeah?
Could you go a little bit slower?
Sure, yeah. So ask questions, you know, as I go along if something is unclear. So we have referencing and dereferencing. So when you want to get the address of a variable, then use the ampersand, right? So let's say I declared int x somewhere and I want to get the address of that and pass it in. I would do ampersand x. And when you want to get the value associated with a pointer, you use the dereference operator, which is a star, right? So let's say I had int star x and I had it pointing to something. If I want to get the value of what it's pointing to, I would just do star x. Is that clear? Any questions about that? Yeah.
So generally, you won't be able to do add x and star x with the same x. Correct? Because if x is a variable, then you have to do at x to get that it's a pointer. But if x is a pointer, then you need to do star x to get the variable.
Yes. So the question was about when do we use a star, when we would use the star and when we use the ampersand, and can we use it with the same type of variable? So usually if you have, like, for example, an int x, you would mostly be using the ampersand, right, to get the address of that, because it doesn't make sense to dereference int x, right? Whereas if we had int star x, you'd be using the dereference the operation, because it would make no sense to use at x in that case. Does that make sense?
So you can't like and then a pointer?
So you technically actually can do the ampersand of a pointer, but that's out of the scope of this class. For your guys' purposes, whenever you have pointers, you want to use the dereference operator to get the value associated with that. And when you have regular variables like an intx, you want to use the ampersand operator to get the address of that. Okay? Okay, so let's look at pointers and what happens under the hood. So the first thing I did here is I declared int x is equal to 5. The address of this variable is 0x04, and the value is 5. So let's see what happens with the next line. So now we declare a pointer. Its address is 0x08, and its value is the address of x. Does that make sense to everyone? Any questions about that? Okay, and now let's see what happens with the next line. So with this next line, we have the address of copy being 0x10, and its value is 5, right? So the reason we got 5 is we said we dereference pointer, right, which we declared an int star, right? And so it went, when we dereference it, it said, okay, what is in the slot 0x04? Right? And it went to that, and what x is an x 0x04, and the value is 5. Does that make sense? Yeah.
Why isn't copy's address just 4 bytes above the address of pointer?
Yes, this is a mistake.
Remember this is written in hexadecimal?
Oh,
This is actually 8 and then 16, because we said that the pointer, remember, in our IDE is going to be 8 bytes long.
Yeah. So just to be clear, pointers are 8 bytes long, and an int is 4 bytes. So the reason why we jumped from 0x04 to 0x08 is because we need to do a jump of 8 bytes. And then since copy is just an int, it's 4 bytes, which is half of 8 bytes. So we just did a jump to 0x10, which is 2 away from 0x8. Yeah. Any other questions? Okay, let's, yeah.
Why isn't the value of in copy just the, why is it 5 instead of, 0x04?
Okay, why is it 5? Okay, so let's first think about this in terms of types, right? So I'm saying int copy is equal to pointer star, right? So what is the type of pointer? It is an int star, right? And when I dereference that, the type becomes an int, right? So what we expect to store here is actually an int. Does that make sense? So usually when you think in terms of types, it helps you understand what is the type of the value that should go there, right? So you can usually rule out a lot of these common errors by thinking in terms of types. Let me go through a little more slides, then we can get questions at the end of the pointer section. Okay, so we have a buggy program here. Can someone tell me what is wrong with this program? Right, so what we're expecting to do here is, what we want to do is take the variable int x and make it equal 5 instead of 3 and then print that. But that's not happening. Can someone tell me why? Yeah.
When the function 2,5 takes x as its argument, it doesn't take x itself, but instead creates a copy a of it. Operations on that, but because of that, you don't change the actual value of x since you're performing operations on it.
Right. So when we call the function 2,5, what we're doing is giving a copy of the value to that function. That function then is going and doing some manipulations, but once it returns, it's now out of scope of the main function here, and so x is still in fact equal to 3, and we print 3. Okay, so let's see how this happens. So so there's nothing declared, then here x is equal to 3, and now, there's at position 2, a is still not in scope, and now we go to position 3, where a now assumes the value of 3. At 4, we now change a to 5, but now when we jump back to 5, which is the print statement, a is now out of scope, and x is still equal to 3. So does this make sense to everyone? Okay, so now let's talk about how we can use pointers to fix this. Does anyone have any ideas how we could fix this by using pointers? Sorry, could you speak up? Okay, yes, so let's pass, instead of passing just the value, let's pass it by reference, this new function, right? And so by passing the address in, we can do manipulations on the address, and so we're actually, in fact, changing x. So let's see how that works. Okay, so in this example, we fixed it, right? We've changed our signature of 2.5 to take in an int star instead of just an int here. Then we dereference this a and assign 5 to it. And now this will, in fact, print 5. So let's see how the steps work here. So with the first step, you know, there's nothing declared yet. So here, with the second step, we've said x is equal to 3, but a is still out of scope. Now by the third line, we have x is still equal to 3, and now we have passed in, what's stored in a is now the address of x. Right? Does that make sense to everyone, how we got that? Right? We have the that's how we pass an ampersand x to the function 2.5, right? And then the next line, what we do is we dereference a, right? And by dereferencing a, we are able to change the value of x from 3 to 5, right? Because x lives at that address 0x12, right? And then finally, when we return back to main, although this A is now out of scope, but we have, in fact, changed X, and it is 5. Any questions about this? Yeah?
Can you explain what the ampersand X was? I thought ampersand was like and.
Yes, yeah, so we use the same symbol for many different things. So here, when you have, in this case, when you have, I guess, So in this case, when you're like kind of dealing with pointers, right? When you put the ampersand in front of like, you know, like an int, a variable int, or a char, or a float, what you're saying is give me the address of this, right? But what you were thinking of when else you would use ampersand is like, let's say in an if statement, right? You have like a true and like some variables that evaluate to some Boolean and some other variables evaluate to some Boolean, and you want to get the and of that, then you use the ampersand.
Yeah. Just today we've talked about three different uses of ampersand. We have two ampersands, which is what Pulak just described. We have one ampersand, which is what Camille described earlier, which is one ampersand, and that's for bitwise and. And notice that both the conditional and, the logical and the bitwise and, those have two numbers, right? It was something, ampersand, ampersand, something. Something, ampersand, something. Here, when we just have ampersand something, that's dereferencing.
Yeah. Great question. Yeah?
Why does in line 5, A and star A become in A? Why don't they just kind of retain the same values from the previous line?
Because we've exited the function. And so what happens, now we're out of scope of that function, what happens actually is like those are removed from memory. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yes. What does that mean? So the question was, what are we doing on line when we say star is equal to 5? So remember, the star is the dereference operator, right? So when A, in this case, is a pointer, right? It's an int star. So when we dereference A by using the star, what we're saying is go to whatever is stored at the address stored in A, right? So A right now has some address stored in it, right? Go to where that address points to, right? And now change whatever that is to 5. Yeah? We're not changing the address of A to 5. A has some address in it, right? Which is the address of the variable of interest, right? And so what we're saying when we dereference is, you know, now we want to change, we're like now referencing the variable of interest directly. Does that make sense?
Another way to think of it is like go to, so A is an address, the star says go to that address and look at its value, and now set its value to 5. So it says go to the address of X, right? which is going to be what's stored in A, and change it to 5.
Yeah.
So the position is where the pointer is going, the address, but the value is an assigned value based on the address.
Yeah. Any other questions about this? Yeah, sorry.
So when you store, so if you're saying
A, yes.
You have to store the X with an ampersand. Why can't you just say X? Because when you're in the pointer, just find
the location of X. So is there a question? Oh. So your question is, why can't we, to the function 2.5, why can't we just pass an X, right? Okay, yeah, so this again goes back to our discussion on types, right? So the function 2.5 is now expecting a type of int star, right? So what is the type of X? X is just an int, right? But what this function expects is an int star, right? So it expects a variable that has like an address stored in it, right? So that's how we have to put the ampersand. And so that's how we pass in the address, which is now, and then interprets that as an int star, yeah. Great question. Any other questions on this? Okay, cool. Okay, so now let's talk about pointer arithmetic. So here, adding and subtracting I, just the pointer by I times size of the type of pointer, bytes. So let's look at how that looks like. So here we've declared int x equals a 5. And now we're going to declare a pointer y and pass in the address of x there, right? So we have that, right? So x is stored at 0x04. So now y is equal to that, right? And can someone tell me what they think will happen when we do y plus equals 1? Yeah. Size type. Yeah, it was, yes. So, right. So it will change to 0x8, right? And because, right, so you use this formula, right? 1 times the size of the pointer, and the pointers are of size. Right.
Is,
sorry, yeah, that's 4 bytes.
So ints are 4 bytes.
So if we had a, let's say we declared, I guess a char, right? What would that, so let's say we had like char x equal to like a or something, right? And we had the address of that at 0x04. What would y plus equals 1 do now? Sorry, what?
0x05.
0x05, right? Does everyone see that? Okay, and now let's say it's a float. What would happen? Anyone? So floats are how many bytes?
4.
Right, so it would be the same thing as this, right? Cool. Okay, and now let's talk about pointers and arrays. So you saw this on the, I think, previous 2 p-sets, where we can treat, so arrays and pointers are not the same thing, but we can treat arrays as pointers, right? So here, you know, we have this array here, right, which has 3 slots. In the first slot, we have 1, 2, and 3, right? So if we, so we can assign that by saying we have array, dereference that, and then when we dereference that, what we're actually doing is referring to the same slot, right? So star array equals 1. We can, how could we write that? What's an alternate way we could write that?
Array 0 equal 1.
Exactly. Does everyone see that? Right, so same thing with here, right? So when we have array plus 1, we do, so even, remember with like arithmetic, right, that we just talked about, when we do plus 1, it'll move it over by 4 bytes, right? Does everyone see that? And that's why when we dereference that, we can set that to 2, and that's how we set the next block to 2, right? And so an alternate way to write that would also be array bracket 0 bracket equals 1. Yes, because you're dereferencing the whole quantity array plus 1. Okay, and same thing for array plus 2. Any questions about this? Yeah.
So arrays automatically set at 0.
Array is, sorry, what?
Like, array is zero. The address of array is just zero.
So the question was, is the address of array just zero? So, no, array has some address, right? When we dereference it, that's, so you can think about, like, literally, like, a pointer pointing to, like, the beginning of that array, right? So that has some address. We don't know what it is, right? But when we dereference it, we know that's the beginning of the array, right? And so when we move by one, we're just moving relative to where that address was, right? Cool. Any other questions? Yeah. Sorry, could you speak up? Sorry, I cannot hear you. Could you say it one more time? Okay, sorry. Okay, cool. Any, yeah?
So when you go in array bracket 3,
yeah.
Isn't there like, wouldn't there be 4 spots like 0, 1, 2, and 3? Why is it not in array 2?
No, so just the convention to see is when we declare the array, right, when the number we put there is how many slots we want. Right? But the indices of the array are actually array 0, array 1, and array 2. Right? So it's just the convention in how we declare arrays. Yeah. Any other questions? Yeah. Yeah. No. So the question was, could you just do star array bracket 0? And then say that equal to 1. So no, what we're saying here is that we can treat arrays as pointers, right? So we have two ways to now reference to the same block, right? So if you have array 0, the type of that is now an int, right? And if you take the star of that, you get like an invalid thing, right? So what we're saying here is there are two alternate ways to refer to the same block. You can either do array bracket 0 equals 1, or you can do dereference array and have that equal to 0. Right, so just two ways of doing the same thing. Yeah.
Why isn't size of int 1 to add to the next block?
Size of int 1. Because that's just the way this C works, right? It just this the way pointer arithmetic is defined. It'll take the pointer and then whatever you add to it, it'll multiply that by the size of whatever the pointer stores. Yeah. Yeah.
We can treat pointers and arrays the same, but that they're different. So what makes them different? What can we not do with one but not the other?
For the purpose of this class, I think it's,
So for example, if you allocate memory and you have a pointer to an integer, for example, if you tried to like start doing pointer arithmetic and go beyond the amount of memory that you allocated, you'd run into errors. We know with arrays, we say ahead of time, okay, I want to allocate, this essentially says I want to allocate enough room for 3 integers, right? And so now we can treat memory as if we have all 3 of those integers. Does that kind of make sense?
Cool. Yeah. Cool. Yeah.
So a star array, is that assigning 1 to the 0th index of the array?
Yes.
Trying to use pointer arithmetic here, but given I don't understand what pointer arithmetic is, so the array plus 1, you're saying that you now want to talk about the first index in the array.
Right. And so the reason that works is array here we can think of as like an int star, right? And so when we do pointer arithmetic on it, remember the formula where we take the, I guess, whatever the current address is, right? And then when we add 1 to it, we actually multiply 1 by the size of the thing we're manipulating, right? So in this case, the size of an int, right? And then we move it forward by that much.
So go pretend to be array star.
Okay, like, yeah.
With your hand, go be.
Or I can just, yeah. So here, okay, so array at the beginning is just like right here, right? So when we dereference array, we were just referring to the first block here, right? But now when I do array plus 1, that is, that arrow is now right here. Does that make sense? Right? Because this block is of size int, right? Which is 4 bytes, right? And so what we're doing is we're moving that pointer by 4 bytes over, right? Like whenever we do arithmetic on it, it will always move it by increments of 4 bytes, right? because this is like an instar. Does that make sense?
So okay. If things in the array were 5 bytes, we'd move it 5 bytes.
Right, so if we had a char star, we'd move it by 1 byte only, right? So in the case of char stars, it would just be move it over by 1, right?
To get the next unit star. Okay.
Yeah. Does that make sense?
We can chat about it more.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, cool. Let's move on to the next section. You're going to...
Yeah, that's me. All right, awesome. Okay, cool. So now we're on to a little bit more general information about memory. I appreciate the fact that we're going pretty quickly. It's a lot of material to get through in an hour and a half. But if there are any topics you want to go more in depth into, we're going to have office hours this week where you can chat with us one-on-one, or you can just come up at the end and we'll chat about things. And as always, feel free to ask questions. Awesome. So here's our picture of memory that we've seen in lecture a billion times. And we know that the stack grows up from the bottom and the heap grows down, right? And what's the difference between things that we keep on the heap and things that we keep on the stack? Someone throw something out there. Yeah?
Is the stack for things that are just impermanent variables that we're just declaring and using in certain functions?
Beautiful, yeah. So anytime we're in a function and we just have some local variables, those are gonna end up on the stack. If instead we call malloc and actually allocate memory, that always comes from the heap. So, yeah. Cool? And so remember that any memory that you allocate using malloc, that's going to end up on the heap. And if you forget to free it, the computer's not going to know that you're done with it. So it's just going to hang out there in memory, and you're essentially leaking that memory. You're losing it because you never told the computer, hey, I'm done using it. Feel free to put other things there. Cool? Any questions there? Yes.
So what kind of memory is stacked, like non-dynamically allocated to what we call
it? Sure, so you could think of it as local variables, actual calls to functions are gonna stack up. Anything else? Yeah.
How do you free the memory without it to the...
Sure, so when you allocate memory on the heap, you call malloc, and so then that gives you back a pointer to some address in memory. So say you called that pointer, right? Then you just say free pointer, and that frees the memory. Other questions? Yes. Dynamically allocated means in the course of your program. So when you call malloc in the middle of your program, at the beginning of the program, there's no memory allocated. And as the computer steps through that code, it's going to allocate the memory. So that's what we mean by dynamically. Good question. Yeah. That's a great question. I think when you allocate an array, it actually puts it on the stack. I'm not positive about that, so don't quote me.
I think it puts it on the stack.
Puts it on the stack. Okay, cool. Confirmed. Other questions? Yeah. Yeah, for your local variables, it automatically puts memory on the stack. What's the point of using malloc? So we saw a bunch of examples, like for example using swap, where we want the scope of the variable to be something beyond just its function call. And we want something that we can like pass around and that we can access from different places. That's where we'd want to put memory on the heap so that all these different functions can access it. Yeah, so one option is, so the question was can we just like can we declare like a global variable essentially? That is one option, but with a lot of those tend to get really messy and we generally think of that as bad design. Yeah. Cool, any other questions? Awesome, okay. Moving on, so this is actually how we allocate memory. We talked about this a little bit. We use this function called malloc and you tell it how many bytes in memory, so how many bytes on the heap you want, and it's going to return the address, so a pointer to a piece of memory that it's allocated for you. So the type is going to be void star. It's going to be a pointer to whatever you decide to put in there. Anytime you call malloc, we already said that you have to free it so we don't have memory leaks. What's the other thing that you absolutely have to do every single time you call malloc? Okay, you have to free. What's the other thing? Check for null. Beautiful. So yeah, it's right there up on the board. If you try to allocate memory and you have no memory left, the computer is going to say, I have nothing to give you, and it gives you back null. Okay? Questions on that? Yeah.
Why would you ever want to declare a pointer with a specific type when void star can handle all pointer types anyways?
Good question. Why would we say like int star as opposed to like void star when void star can handle everything. So we don't want to ever explicitly cast pointers. It's just bad practice. But we will talk about like instars just as a understanding of this is a pointer to an integer. Yeah, and it allows you to manipulate the values in it as integers.
Okay.
Yeah.
And void star, wouldn't you do that?
It depends on the context. Yeah, so don't worry too much about the type there. Just know that, like, in general, malloc returns a pointer to something.
Okay.
Yeah, cool question.
Sure,
so I was just doing a random example here where I wanted to allocate enough room to store 10 integers. Just a random choice. Yeah. Yeah, what's up?
What do you mean by checking for null? Do you want to check the pointer for null or the malloc?
Yes, exactly. So the question was, what do we mean by check by null? We want, anytime we call malloc and we're returned a pointer, we want to say, is pointer equal to null? So literally PTR, is PTR equal to null? Yes.
So I was kind of wondering, like, if you initialize a pointer
That's a great question. Yeah, if you call malloc, the pointer that, let's say, so here we allocate 10 bytes of memory. So, I'm sorry, enough room for 10 integers. We're going to get the address of that first piece of the memory. That's a great question. Yeah. Yeah, so can you use this as an array of integers? Yeah, exactly. This is what Pulak just showed you on a couple slides ago, where we say, okay, this is really just kind of, we can think of it as an array of 10 integers. Just happens to be on the heap.
But you couldn't access it with square bracket notation.
You actually could access it with square bracket notation, yeah. You can treat them the same. Yes?
Why would pointer ever be null?
If you use up all of the memory on your heap, if your program is eating up memory and there's nothing left, then malloc's going to say, if you say, I want 100 more bytes, it's going to say, I don't have 100 bytes. Here's null. That means I failed. Cool? Yes.
In that case, null is nothing, right?
Yes, in that case, null is nothing. You have no address. There is no memory. Cool. All right. Moving on. Okay, let's talk really quickly about buffer overflow. When might we encounter buffer overflow? Let's say we allocate a chunk of memory and we're going to write the string in. And we're going to say, okay, I'm going to allocate enough room for 6 characters. And I'm going to ask the user for some input. And the user inputs, for example, hello. And that fits perfectly fine because we have room for all the characters of hello and the null terminating character. Plenty of room, no problem. But what if we give the opportunity for an evil user to use our program, and they type in not 6 characters or not 5 characters, but a million, right? They keep typing and typing and typing. What's going to happen? Well, we only gave the computer enough, or sorry, we only gave this string enough space for 5 characters. So we're going to get something like this, where the evil person who's typing an input can overwrite the size of the buffer and can go actually past the amount that it's originally allocated. And then what you can do, the really evil thing you can do, is overwrite the return address, which basically means you can kind of take control of the behavior of the program. So at a very high level, buffer overflow is when you allocate some amount of memory, and then you, because you're taking user input or something like that, you go over the bounds of what you've originally allocated and start messing up your program. Yes? Why wouldn't that return a segmentation fault? It could. Sometimes the compiler or while your runtime is actually going to check that if certain things happen, and this is kind of lower level than you need to know. But if you don't design these systems properly, then you have the chance of not catching it and just allowing the computer to take, or the evil person to take control of your computer. Sure. Oh, so when I say buffer, I just mean the amount of memory that you've allocated. So here I said, oh, we've allocated enough room for 6 characters, and I just call that my buffer, where I might write information. Yeah. Any other questions on this? Yeah.
How do you stop it?
awesome question. How do you stop it? How do you prevent buffer overflow? Well, one way to do it is something like getString, where we constantly increase the amount of memory that we allocate if the user enters a lot of text. Another thing is, if you only want 6 characters, do a quick check. Say, only input 6 characters. Yeah. So if, let's say, you were working on, like, we're going to get to web stuff a little bit later in the course, but let's say you're, like, working on a form, you would just limit how much could be handed in. Yeah?
Getstring calls memory from the stack, right, just to clarify.
One more time?
Does getstring take memory from the stack?
I believe getint takes memory from the heap because it calls alloc.
Okay.
Malloc and realloc. Other questions? Yeah.
So by defining the size of the buffer, you prevent someone from being able to inject code that can slide past the deg fault?
So by defining the size of the buffer, you've said, okay, here's how much memory we can use. If you allow the user to write over it, then you're going to run into problems. Make sense? Cool. All right, awesome. Let's move along. All right. So here's some. Speaking of errors, here are some common error messages that might have shown up while you were coding, working on your problem sets. Good chance that one of these shows up on the quiz if past years are any indication. So entries are kind of up here on the board, but feel free to shout out some more. Why might a segmentation fault happen? Why might you get a segmentation fault when you're running your program? Good. If we try to access memory that's not given to us, if we dereference a null pointer, for example, if we call malloc and forget to check if it's null, and we just try using it, the computer's going to give us a segmentation fault. Good. What about implicit declaration of function? What does that mean? Good. You're trying to use a function that you haven't defined. So that could be one of two things. Maybe it was like the example that Camille showed you earlier, and you have a main function that calls something called cube, and let's say you forgot to write the prototype. You forgot to say, hey computer, I have this function called cube. You'll see it later. Let's say you forgot to write the prototype, you might get this error. Another thing is, let's say you try to use printf and forgot to include the standard library, then it's going to say implicit declaration of function. And last but not least, undeclared identifier. Yeah?
Problem scope, like maybe you're trying to call like a local variable that's in a different sort of area.
Good, great. So if you have a variable that's like not in scope and you're trying to use it, you're going to get in trouble. And just more generally, let's say you try to use x with ever saying like int x equals 5, then you're going to run into trouble. Excuse me, questions on this? Awesome, chugging right along. Okay, recursion. I lost my schedule. Oh, here we go. Just make sure we're roughly on schedule. All right, cool. Okay, recursion. The general idea of a recursive function is a function that calls itself. Okay, so that's what I mean by a program concept whereby a function calls itself. What's a good reason to use recursion? When might it be useful? Or what's a program that really lends itself to recursion?
Binary search
lends itself to recursion because you have this problem that you can break down into smaller pieces and continuously perform the same algorithm on it. This leads to, in many cases, more elegant code that's more precise. We just heard the example of binary search. Another example is merge sort. Sometimes when you like think of an algorithm like factorial, it just feels recursive, right? Because we know that the factorial of 5 is the factorial of 4 times 5, right? And so when you set up a problem that way, it just feels recursive. So that would be a great way to write it. Questions? Yes. What's a base case? I said don't forget to include a base case. Let's say we were writing a factorial function, and we're doing factorial of 5. We know factorial of 5 is 5 times the factorial of 4, blah, 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 blah. How do we know when to stop? How do we know that we actually have a number? Because if we kept calling factorial, then we'd never get an answer, right? So when do we know how to stop in the example of factorial? Anyone? Yeah. Good. So we know, like, we can take for granted that 1 factorial is equal to 1. So if we get to the point where we're calling factorial on 1, just go ahead and return 1. And that's your base case. Because we know once we hit that, and we always will hit that, we will never, we won't like just keep going forever. Cool. Any other questions on recursion? Yes. Yeah, so when you call return one, if let's say factorial of two calls factorial of one, factorial of one will just hand back one, and now factorial of two will say, okay, two times one is two, and return that answer. Cool. Yes?
Do we have to worry about scope in recursion when we're going into an
algorithm? Yes. Yeah, so you do have to worry about scope in the context of recursion. So only the variables defined in that run of the function are going to be usable. Yeah, good question. All right, let's keep moving along because we have a lot of material to get through. But as I said, feel free to hit up office hours or us after the fact. This is just a really quick slide. We've learned a lot about searches and sorts. Please, 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 these sections are online, I believe at cs50.net/quizzes. So go take this chart and put it on your review sheet because there will be a question on this. Please don't get it wrong. Just very quickly, what this chart means is it talks about big O, which we know to be the upper bound of an algorithm's running time, and we have omega, which is going to be the lower bound of an algorithm's runtime. Okay? Yeah, what's the last thing? What's theta? It is if we're only going to care about it in this class in the case where our upper bound and our lower bound are the same. That's the only time it'll come up in this class. Okay, I'm gonna keep going. If you haven't taken your picture, I promise these will be online. Okay, awesome, structs. Why might we want structs? What's a useful reason we might want structs? Someone shout something out. Well, let's look at the example on the board. Let's say we're dealing with all of these students, right? Like, if we're making a program for CS50, there are like 800 people. We're gonna need to handle a lot of information about students. It would be nice if we can kind of group this all of the information that has to do with a particular student into one data type. But we know that there's no data type called student, right? We have an integer, we have a float, we have a string, or a char star, but we don't have a student. So what we can do is actually kind of define our own structure, call it student, and we can associate some different fields with that struct. So in this case, let's say we have a student, and the things that we care about are the student's ID number and the student's name. And now we can associate this ID and this name with a given student. So let's see some examples. Okay? So here I say, okay, let's say we want to make a student. I call him student one. And his ID number, in this case, we can access by just doing the name of the student dot the field we want to access. So this is going to just be student one dot ID, and we set it equal to one. Because remember, we said that ID is going to be an integer. And very similarly, we can say the student's name is going to be Davin, for example. So we can just access fields of a struct using this dot. Questions on that? Yeah? Is there any way you can protect your variables from being externally accessed? Not in the scope of CS50. Other questions? What does typedef struct? What does each component mean of this guy? Okay, cool. So this says, hey computer, I want to create a new structure, and I'm going to define a definition for it, right? Such that I could use it as if it were a type throughout my program. Okay, so I want to define a structure, and I'm now going to be able to use it as a type. And its name is student, and here are its fields. If you want to be able to use a struct throughout your program, and in most cases in CS50 we do, we have to say typedef. And that allows us to use it the same way that we use like int or float. The computer will always know what it is. Yeah?
Do we write this in the header file?
Oh, sorry. Do we write this in the header file? You could write this at the top of your program, at the top of your C program. Yeah, that would be the most reasonable place for it. Back there?
That's a good question. So before in main or something?
Right, you need this to be somewhere that everyone can access it. So before it main in your case, yeah.
Is there a difference between putting student on top and on bottom?
Is there a difference between putting student on top or on bottom? Save that question, and when we get to linked lists, we'll see that. Okay? So hold on to that for 1 second. The last thing I want to mention here is if instead of having a structure, we have a pointer to a structure, we can change our notation to be a little nicer. We can say, let's say we have a pointer to a student rather than just a student. If we want to access a field, Instead of doing, well, go dereference the pointer and then access the field name, this notation looks a little messy with this star and this dot, totally correct. But a kind of cleaner way to do it is just to say pointer arrow name. And that actually combines dereferencing and accessing in one beautiful symbol. Questions on that?
Just say that one more time.
Say that one more time. Sure, exactly what I just said. If we have a pointer to a student rather than the student itself, one way that we can access the field is to dereference it and then access name, right? Another nicer way we can do it, which is just a little bit of syntactic sugar, is just to do pointer arrow name. And that is going to combine the dereferencing and the accessing. Yeah, pretty cool. All right, so let's talk about the other question. Let's jump to nodes, which we're gonna use in linked lists in just a second. So here, you'll notice that there is the word node both on the bottom and on the top, right? Before, when we were defining student, we just had student on the bottom. We didn't have student on the top. Anyone know why that might be? What the difference is? Yeah. Good, yeah. We need our nodes to have pointer to other nodes. So since we use this type before it's actually defined, we need to put it at the top just so it knows what it is.
So we still need it at the bottom?
Yes.
So always at the bottom.
Always at the bottom. Yeah. So all of yours will have it at the bottom. Any other questions? All right, so let's actually talk about linked lists really quickly. So linked lists are, we use them instead of arrays in some cases because we know that arrays are a fixed length, whereas linked lists, we can grow and shrink as we want. So this is an example of what a linked list might look like. What we need to save is the head of the list, so where the list starts, and then each subsequent node is responsible for knowing where the next node is. So in this case, the node that stores 1 is responsible for knowing where 3 is. The person that stores 3 is responsible for knowing where 9 is. And 9 has no one else to point to. It's the end of the list, so it just says null. Okay?
What's the point of this?
What's the point of this?
Yeah.
Because let's say we have some data, and we don't know exactly how much data we want ahead of time. So with an array, let's say we want to count people in the first row. Chances are it's not going to change. We can just say, okay, I want an array of size 6, right? But if we want something that's going to change, for example, let's say I were trying to keep track of the students as they come into the room for the review session. I have no idea how many of you people are going to show up. So I might want a data structure that I can expand and shrink because maybe someone will leave, maybe someone will come. And so at any time, we can add or remove nodes.
Okay.
Cool, great question. Yeah?
You can use something like get string that like keeps letting you get more data as you need it. Why do you need this too?
Why would you use linked lists when you can use something like get string? That's a good question. Remember that one of the downfalls of getString is that we didn't do a very good job of freeing that memory, and we introduced a bunch of memory leaks into your program. You could take a statically sized array and keep growing it, but you'd have to find new places in memory. It would just be a lot of overhead. One of the nice things about linked lists as opposed to arrays is arrays are all in the same location in memory. It has to be continuous chunks of memory, whereas linked lists, 2 and 3 may be totally in different locations. Like 2 is over here and 3 is over here. And as long as they have a pointer to one another, it's fine. We know we can find them. Question over there?
Well, getString is a function in the CS50 library, right?
Yeah.
It doesn't exist in real programs.
Correct. And right, that's the other thing. GetString doesn't exist outside of the context of CS50. Yeah. That is a great question. The question was, does it impact the efficiency of accessing these different elements in the list? Actually, yes, because we know if, let's say we want to access the second element of the array, we know we can just do array bracket 1, right? It's always going to be in the same location. But if we want to get to that 3, we can't just say, go get that 3. We have to say, okay, start at the beginning of the list, and now we actually have to walk through until we find the number we're interested in. So in this case, we say, okay, this is the first number, so essentially that's index 0. Now we have to find the second number, that's index 1. So that's actually going to, just accessing is going to take n time. Cool? Big O of n. Yeah?
What are each of the lists? Are they each arrays or what?
That's a great question. What are each of these structure that I've drawn? They are nodes. So each of these little structure has two parts. It has an integer that it holds. That's the actual data that it's holding onto. That's the kind of useful part. And this is what makes it a linked list. It has a pointer to the next node. Awesome question. All right, so let's look very quickly look at some examples of what we might do with linked lists. So one very quick example is suppose we want to do a search. What kind of search can't we do on linked lists? Binary. Why can't we use binary search? Right, because with binary search, we had to rely on the fact that we could just kind of jump into the array at any point. We could just say, go to the middle element. With here, as we said a little bit earlier, we can't just jump to the middle element. In order to find any element, we actually have to walk through our whole list. So if we wanted to do search, the best we can do is just a linear search. We start at the head, we check, let's say we're looking for 9. We start at the head, we say, is this 9? No. Is this 9? No. Is this 9? Yes, we found it. Okay, that's all that's saying. Here's a little bit of pseudocode. I'm going to leave this for you guys to turn over on your own just because we're running a little bit short on time. Let's talk about insertion. We saw a really cool demo of this in lecture where we said, okay, we have this linked list where everyone's pointing to one another, and someone comes up on the stage. How do we insert that person into our linked list? Well, a wrong way to do it, which is I think what we saw first, is when the person in front automatically pointed to the new person, right? And then we kind of abandoned the second half of the list, right? Because we don't know where it is in the memory anymore. So we have to be very careful about the order in which we insert things. So here, let's say we want to put 1 at the front of our list. First, we have 1 point at the second element, or the element that contains 1. So we point to that just so we're not going to lose the second half. And now we can have head point to 1. So again, this is just super high level. This is how we would insert a node. We have a lot of pseudocode here. I don't know why I'm calling it pseudocode. It's actual code. You can go check it out later. All right. Let's very quickly, do any more questions on linked lists before I move on to a couple other data structures in our last 10 minutes?
Do we need to know how to write it in a test?
We do need to. You should be prepared to write, insert, remove, and search for linked lists on the test. That is something that we could expect you to do. Just go over it. If you have any questions on the code, shoot your TF an email, come to office hours. There's still lots of time to study, not to worry. All right, any other questions about linked lists? Yeah?
So if you don't use the pointer to go to the one on the right before you use the pointer to go on the left, that's the equivalent of deleting everything, right?
Yeah. Right, since we can't get it, it's actually even worse because not only do we not know where it is, we can no longer use it, but we're not freeing that memory anymore. So it's just hanging around and not being useful because we can't find it. Yeah, cool question. All right, let's talk about stacks. We saw stacks very quickly. They are first in, last out data structures. So we think of the stacks in Annenberg of trays where we stack things on top. And if you're gonna come get a tray, you're always gonna want to take the one on the top, which is the thing that we most recently put on top of the stack. So you can kind of think of this kind of visual when you're thinking of stacks, and then we pop something off the top of the stack. And the words that we use when we're talking about these data structures is usually, if we put something on the stack, we say we're pushing it on the stack, and if we take something off the stack, we say we're popping off the stack. If you're going to implement a stack, which I definitely recommend you try out, you're going to want to keep track of, let's say you're using an array. I know in lecture we talked about using both arrays or linked lists to implement a stack. If you're using an array, we need to keep track of the size and the capacity, so the maximum number that our stack can hold. Questions on stacks? Difference between size and capacity. Awesome question. So let's say we're using an array, and we allocate enough room for 10 integers. And we start to fill that up, and we push things on, and we pop things off. We want to keep track of the maximum number we can hold. That's capacity. And we want to keep track of the current number we have. That's size. Good question. Anything else on stacks? All right, let's talk about surprise queues. Unlike stacks, which are first in, last out, These are first in, first out. So this is like, think of a line. Think of lining up at the Apple store to get whatever product, and the first person on the line should be the first person who's helped. So first thing that's pushed is the first thing that's popped. Cool? Very similarly, the words that we use instead of push and pop, which I just used, I'm sorry, is we say if we're putting something into the queue, we say we enqueued it. If we're taking something out of the queue, we say we dequeued it. Maybe pronouncing those wrong, but you get the idea. Okay? And then again, just like stacks, if we're implementing this as array, we need to keep track of the size, the capacity, and the head. What do I mean by the head? Why do we need to keep track of the head? Yeah, basically the head is where the beginning of our queue is, because we know, unlike stacks, which I'm going to try to face this way, we know that it's always going to shrink this way and grow this way. Queues, people come onto the end and leave from the beginning, so we have to keep track of where the start is. That's what I mean by we need to keep track of where the head is. Cool? All right. 8 minutes, couple more topics, we can do it. All right, hash table. We talked very briefly about hash tables. For the quiz, you just need to understand them at a high level. The basic idea is you have all this data, and we want to access it in time that's faster than something like a linked list, because we said if we were searching through a linked list, that could take n time. Even accessing can take n time in a linked list. Hash tables give us a way that we can more quickly access things and more quickly search for things without having the restraints of an array where we have fixed size. So we think of a data structure where we put it in the data structure is dependent on this magical hash function. So in this case, the magical hash function is just taking a word, checking what the first letter is, and then just sorting it alphabetically. So we essentially put them into different buckets. When we see banana, we say, okay, let's put it in the B bucket. When we see apple, let's put it in the A bucket. If we saw apricot, let's put it in the A bucket. Okay? So suppose I were looking for, I don't know, what's another fruit? Suppose I were looking for orange. Where should I look? In the O bucket. Yeah, there's only one place that orange might be. Okay? So I said earlier, what happens if, well, I said earlier, let's say you put apricot in. But I didn't really address the fact that, oh no, if I were put berry in, it's going to conflict with banana. Where do we put it if there's already something in our table? Well, we have a couple options. Option number one is linear probing, which basically means, let's say I want to try to put berry, and I see, oh no, banana's already there. I just say, okay, let me look for the next available spot. So I walk down, I say, oh, there's nothing in the D bucket. I can't really think of any fruits that start with the letter D. So I'm just going to put berry in there. Durian. Okay, so since there's nothing in there yet, I might as well just use that spot. What's the disadvantage of this? Sorry? We might end up with things that are sorted into buckets in the way that we expect them to be. So if we were searching for berry, before we said, oh, we can just look in one bucket. It could only be in one bucket. But now, really, it could be in all the buckets, right? Okay. Here's another option, separate chaining, which is the idea that that we're going to use a little bit later in PSEP 5. Rather than just have one space in each bucket, why don't we have each bucket be a pointer to a linked list, where we say, okay, there is a bucket for everything that starts with A, and there's just going to be a linked list of fruits that start with A. So if we get a new fruit, let's say we get, we have avocado, we have apple, let's say we get apricot, how would we put it in the list? Well, we go to bucket 0, and we just insert it in our linked list. Simple as that. Now, I keep saying bucket. We could implement this in a number of ways. One typical way that this kind of picture suggests is maybe having an array of pointers to linked lists. That's one way we could implement a hash table.
Would you need another list because banana and berry are out of order?
Would you need another list because banana and berry are out of order? In this case, our hash function, which tells us where to put things, doesn't care about the second letter. It doesn't care about alphabetizing. It only cares about the first letter. Question. Good. Okay, so we don't need to worry too much for this quiz. So I didn't put it in these slides. We're going to be introduced to it for PSEP 5. But basically, it says, given a new element, where should I put it? Or, let's say I'm looking for an element, where might it be? Great question. Okay, very quickly, trees and tries. So a tree is just any sort of organized data structure. And we're going to see a lot of pictures that will make this super clear. And a try, which we saw in class, is a very special kind of tree that essentially works like a multi-level hash table. It's super cool. We're going to see it in just a sec. All right, so let's talk about trees first. So this is a really typical example of a tree where we have some hierarchy. You see that one is at the very top, right? And I can say top because there's clearly an ordering because we have these arrows going down. So that the thing at the top, I call that the root node. So one is the root node. And the things at the bottom, which have nothing coming off them, I say these are the leaf nodes. So 8, 9, 5, 6, 7. Okay? And usually the terminology we can say is 1 is 3's parent. So it's the thing that comes a level above it and points to it. And 3 is 1's child. It's the thing that 1 points to. Question? Can I go back to the previous slide? Sure. Questions on this, or you just wanted to look at it? Okay, cool. Yeah. These will all be online, so don't worry about getting every word. And in the interest of time, I'm going to go. Is that okay?
Yeah.
Awesome. Okay, cool. So let's talk about a very specific kind of, so we have these general structure of trees, which is just anything that allows us to kind of rank things hierarchically. Can't say that word, you know what I mean. Binary trees are things where every node has at most 2 children. Okay? And I said, okay, so that seems to fit this description. I said, no, not a binary search tree. What's a binary search tree? It's sorted. So you know that in a binary search tree, everything to the node's left is smaller, and everything to the node's right is bigger. So this is not a binary search tree. This is just a binary tree. So we have big category of trees, slightly smaller category of binary trees, binary search trees. Cool? All right. And now, most fun of all, we have our tries. You guys saw this picture in lecture? Yeah, should look super familiar. Let's look at how we might actually implement this. Or actually, let's see, does that even come up? Nope. All right, we don't even have to worry about that low-level stuff. We will have plenty of time to address that in PSET 5. But for now, just very high level, we know that this is what it looks like. We described it as kind of a multi-level hash table where, what does this store? This stores names of scientists that we can actually look for by just kind of following the different hash tables down. All right? And the pros of this is, in theory, they provide constant time lookup. So if I want to check that, for example, Mandel is in this try, I could very quickly, in constant time, figure out whether or not it's in the try. But a con is that look how big this is. We're not even storing that much data, and it is huge. So one big con is that it uses a large amount of memory. Yes?
Why does it provide constant time exactly?
One more time?
What's the intuition for why it provides constant time?
Excellent question. Why does it provide constant time? So what you can do is, let's say we're looking for Mendel. We know that we want to start in the first level at M. We know we want to follow it to E. So that's take one step, two steps, right? We follow it to N, we follow it to D, we follow it to E, we follow it to L. And then the next thing we check says, this delta says, yes, that's in our table. That is a word. That is a valid entry in our try. So you're saying, OK, that took 7 steps. But if we added like a zillion more scientists to this data structure, we wouldn't have to check a zillion more things. We're only ever going to have to take 7 steps, the length of the person's name. So we like to think of like runtime as, suppose we increase the size of our data structure, how much longer is it going to take? In this case, if we add a bunch of more scientists, doesn't matter. It's going to still take the same amount of time. It's constant time. Yes?
How do you know how to scan over the other numbers?
How do I know how to?
Like, how do you know you go straight from M to E and not M to A?
Oh, sure, because I knew I was looking for the word Mendel, and I just know it's M-E. So that, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah.
Ah, wouldn't I have to look at the, okay, great, this is a great question. It depends how we implement it. If we implement it as just like a series of arrays where we know that E is always at position 0, I don't know, whatever number index E is at, yeah, we can just do constant time, do.
Okay.
Cool. Question over there?
Is constant time the same thing as real time?
Is constant time the same thing as real time? I'm not really sure what real time is.
Like time
Yeah, you can think of it that way. In other words, it's not dependent on the size of the data structure. That's a way to think of it. Any other questions? Maybe in the first time in history we finished on time. If you have any questions, feel free to come ask us. Go to section, talk to your TFs. Office hours are 8 and 8:30 to 11 on Monday and Tuesday. So it's a little bit different time, so make sure you note that. Yeah. Command line arguments and Linux commands, yes, you need to know those. Very, like, it's like the kind of level stuff we cover in section zero, as far as Linux commands go. Office hours, I'm not entirely sure where they are, but you can check the website and they will tell you.